If you come to me in the Western world and you don't look me in the eye, and if you are very quiet and you won't say anything, you're dishonest. But you go into the native world, and it's rude to not listen. It's rude to stare at somebody. And all of a sudden, what's interpreted in one world is the opposite in the other world. And teachers yet are teaching students in, because they're not prepared to culturally present this, that they are taking Western models and bringing them in without using any traditional models or traditional background to kind of give the person the best of both worlds. Why do Native people go to college? Well, of our survey, we found that 30% of the survey, 30% were going to school to get better prepared for a job. We found that of all the students at UAA, that only 4% were preparing for graduate school. Now, graduate school, we are talking about the future of us running our own affairs. Unless we are our own doctors, our own lawyers, our own bankers, our own publishers, our own everything, we are going to be subservient to the system. And the big complaint of the college students was not only that the motivation wasn't there, I can go home and be a carpenter and drop out of school and be a carpenter and make more than I would even if I had this degree, so there's that financial motivation, but they're not being prepared realistically for what the price of going to graduate school means. I think it's starting to go up, but we're still finding that people are not being realistically prepared in school, and that school districts, for political reasons or whatever, are not making enough demands. Not that everyone should be a doctor, not that everyone should be a lawyer, absolutely not. But what I'm saying is that if I go to school in Shungnak, I should get the same education as if I was going to West High School. I should be able to walk out of that village and with a standardized examination, I should be able to at least begin to survive in college just as everyone else has. We're paying the same teachers, the same salaries, the same state standards, and it's not working. We're finding that students thought it was difficult to really meet college expectancies. It was very hard for them to start getting involved in discussions in class. Many people felt that there were academic deficiencies, again, in their preparation. We found that most of the people going to college right now, that English was their primary language, which is obviously a change from our own parents, where they learned something else, some native dialect first. Finances were a problem, but in general, native corporations were coming around, and the BIA and student loans seemed to get people through. What they really wanted was really one thing that you lose when you come to Anchorage and other places is the sense of extended family, which plays such a major role, as you know, in the villages. People found that it was difficult for them to call on people to find a support system. And this is why we began the Native Student Organization. They asked, why don't our regional corporations recognize and honor their shareholders when they graduate from ACC or UAA? In fact, I often remember people say, well, go be a doctor, be a teacher, whatever. And that's wonderful. But during those lonely, dark years of being a student, when you're broke and you're lonely and you want to quit every other day, you wonder if anybody else is out there. And then, of course, when you graduate, oh, where have you been? They're just happy to see you and to hire you. But the support is not basically there in the beginning. And that, I think, is another reason that we are not being able to get more Native people through this Western system of education. Students said, would the corporations with headquarters in Anchorage be willing to host some student social events? Could internships or similar practical training programs be expanded? We want our corporations and our people to provide us with support, not only financial support, just moral support. Let people know that they're there. The students also requested that, in terms of improving the system, that more Alaska Natives be employed as faculty members. But it's very, very difficult to find qualified Alaska Natives at this point historically that can fit into the system. And unfortunately, I'm the only Alaska Native faculty member at UAA, and so we have a long way to go.
And what about Fairbanks?
Fairbanks, there are two Alaska Natives on the faculty up there. And at ACC, I think there is one counselor on their ACC faculty, and that's it. They're asking that additional courses on Alaska Native topics be added, that better information before college is needed, that catalogs be easier to understand, that registration processes be simplified, and so on. The question is that I have, and walking out of these, in and out of both worlds as a counselor, my role of advising academically Native students is that what do we do in the real world of the university and the state? You can't really discriminate and for any one particular group. So it's a difficult question. Do you make special allowances for Alaska Natives versus the rest of the population? Academically, we do not. But we begin to look at problems that and questions that have never been asked before with Native students finally going to school and graduate school and beginning to come back. There have been a number of empty promises, I think, on the part of people saying, come to school when you come back. We really want to train you to take over our position. I've seen this in Indian Health. I've seen this in other federal agencies. And that when the person graduates and comes back, they aren't really terribly accepted. I know a Native anthropologist right now that just graduated with her doctorate and came back here and could not find a job anywhere, including with their Native corporation, and had to leave and take a job in New York. And so, again, why are people being educated? Where is the reality of the jobs coming to come back to? And again, the other difficult question we'll have to ask is it realistic to expect a person to come back to their village? And especially in medicine, it's impossible to go back to a village and practice in one village because to justify in some terms a full-time physician, for example, in a village, you need a population of several thousand people. And so, again, we have our community health aides and the importance of their role. And so there are a number of new questions that are coming up today that I don't have the answer for, that I would like to propose to the commission. And I think that there is a sense of hope because we're beginning to not only talk to each other, but we're beginning to talk to other countries and other people in our own same situation. And again, people are starting to look at themselves and saying, who are we? where do we want to go? What do we want to take from both societies? And I think that'll be the answer. I think that's the only way we'll be able to maintain our cultural integrity as well as be able to function realistically in both worlds and not be dependent on one culture or another in this very subservient relationship we find ourselves in today. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Mala. Maybe I could just ask you a couple of questions. You're well acquainted with health in other circumpolar countries, and for northern native peoples in Canada, Eskimo people of Greenland, is the impact of Western society producing more or less the same figures in terms of alcoholism and violence and suicide and so on, or are there differences that, and if there are, what significance do you give them?
We're finding in relationship to ourselves in Canada, of course there is this imaginary geographic line that divides us, and yet we're part of the same landmass and I think part of the same family. We're finding that the condition that we were in years ago, a number of Canadians are still in that position. Let me go a step further. They have just are in the process of resolving their own land claim settlement acts, and I was consulting Whitehorse about 2 years ago and talking to the Yukon Indians, the Council of Yukon Indians, on how to set up a health corporation and how we were in the same position that they're in today, how we were in that position 10 years ago. I think that we are more advanced than the Canadians, but advanced does not necessarily mean progress. It means advanced that I think we're more advanced because we have more cancer, because we have more stress, and I think we have more suicide. But I think that's coming to the Canadians. I think that this same cultural shock and infusion of everyone else's culture going into them is just beginning. And we are actually beginning to do some studies, for example, in fetal alcohol syndrome and between Canadian natives and Alaska natives to see what the incidences are. There haven't been that many studies between both our countries, but there have been a number of discussions, and the Canadians are beginning to look at us as a model for both a positive and negative role model on what has happened to us, and are beginning to hopefully learn from some of our experiences. As you know better than I from your own work in Canada, they have difficult questions such as status and non-status, which we never had to resolve, which I think are based on or bordering on something morally unacceptable as well as legally, to think that a person is even being full-blooded native cannot use any of the rights that other native people have, the difference between the status and the non-status. So I think that they are in the position that we were in years ago, but I still think that they have a chance to avoid some of the things that we have that's happening. But the problem is with so much money coming in, the infusion of television in every village and radio and access, basically access, is most dramatic. And historically in Alaska, you could look and actually see the villages that were affected by the Russians and the trade with the Russians as opposed to the more isolated Inuit of the north. And that the Tlinkets and the Haidas were much more adapted to fighting and to being untrustful and so on because of their relations continually with the Indians. And the Russians, and having to go through all these wars, whereas the Inuit did not really have to do any major wars that we're aware of, and were extremely trusting and open, as the Indians were when the Europeans first contacted them. And so you can look at the villages and see how people actually responded. And I think that comparison can be made today, looking at villages that are accessible by road versus villages that are inaccessible or just by water or air. Yeah. And I think in Canada you're going to see the same thing. I don't know what's going to happen with the new highway that's just gone into the north, and I think accessibility is going to bring more modernization, for better or worse, but I believe that the problems are going to intensify. The good and the people have to just begin to make the decision of what they're going to accept and what they're not. Sure. And that's starting to happen, but hopefully it's not too late in some cases.
You mentioned the Russians. You've been to the Soviet Union. Are you able to say whether or not for the Eskimos in Russia, for instance, the same cultural difficulties are occurring, the same troubles, the same problems?
I've asked permission this May to go into Siberia to look at some of the native communities. As you know, they've been really restricted, and the only Eskimos that I have worked with, namely Ururithu and those, the Soviet medical native writers group, I don't think are really representative of what I've heard. I've heard many stories of that people in general are not allowed into those communities because of the condition of the people, that certain people are embarrassed at the level of care that native people have there. But I can't say that I've seen it firsthand.
Maybe after your visit in May you will be able to tell us.
I hope so.
You had a question about cancer.
Yes. Yes, Thomas Nusengenya from Barrow. In my analysis in working with ARCO, you know, their technology in the cleaning process of natural gas, they use a carcinogenic chemical to get rid of the moisture in the gas along with the oil. From my standpoint, you know, that is the use of glycol or triethylene glycol. Mm-hmm. And I feel very strongly that this carcinogen is mm-hmm. Put into the gas that burns as a source of heat, as a source of cooking. And I feel I've looked at it, and you know, from a technical point of view, mm-hmm. and analyzing their technology in cleaning this natural gas is in a way putting in a carcinogen directly into the fuel here. And I was wondering if you have looked into the different sources of cooking, the different sources of heat that all the Inupiat, you know, in various communities use, you know, like, for instance, in Barrow, have you analyzed their technology in their cleaning process of natural gas? And, you know, I just had to bring that mm-hmm. question.
Thank you very much, yes. If you stay there, maybe you could respond a little bit more. To preface it, people know that the Arctic is a very fragile desert. In essence, it is a desert, and that any change in this northern frozen desert will take 20 to 30 to maybe 100 or hundreds of years to repair. So the Arctic is very fragile. And we are just beginning to look at the effects of certain types of pollutions. For example, we are looking at the pollution coming from the factories of Siberia and the effects of sulfur particles in the air.
And Arctic haze, is that?
Arctic haze, yes. And we know that different particles are brought, especially in acid rain, across the, not only from Russia, but around the world. We're seeing that inversion layers are being created. We're seeing that the Arctic, in essence, and the polar ice cap is warming up. And people are worried because the pollution of this inversion layer, this Arctic haze, is reflecting a lot of the light back down to the ground, and the temperature is actually warming up. We're starting to see things in Barrow that we have never seen anywhere before. For example, utilidors. We're beginning to see what happens to people when they work under the ground, what happens to chemicals that have never been tested. Wind chill factor in Barrow, in North Slope yesterday, minus 100. What happens? They don't test a lot of these chemicals. What are the effects of people working in this environment? What are the effects of these chemicals? Do they chemically change? What happens when you work with these chemicals in a closed, sealed environment under the ground? We're even seeing, even with antibiotics, that there are certain types of antibiotics that are not real effective in the cold, in some types of pathogens, some type of bacteria and so on, that we have to even treat a little bit longer because of the effect in the cold and the north. And so to answer your question in a nutshell, some chemicals have been tested. That particular one, as far as I know, has not. The North Slope Borough has been quite responsive in the health department in getting a grant this past year from the state government. I believe the grant was in the amount of around $100,000 to do a study of cancer in the north. What are the patterns of cancer in Alaska, especially in Barrow and hopefully Kotzebue and Nome and so on. And that study, at this point, they're looking at trends and looking at prevention. But I know of no study that has been initiated either by the borough or by the state to look at all the different types of chemical usage on the North Slope that you are personally working with. The problem is that obviously the study costs a lot of money, which is always the perhaps the bureaucratic cop-out for it. But unfortunately, the way I see things justified in the state is that we have a SWAT squad type of responsiveness to any kind of emergency. Oh, we're having suicides in this village. Let's send a team of experts right in and see if we can cure it. I think it's going to, unfortunately, the Inuit people, I think, are going to have to prove or come down with illnesses or cancer before the state or the federal government will react. I think that's a reality. I don't think it's fair. I don't agree with it. But even looking at you mentioned heating sources. One of the autopsies that were done on Greenland people and the Barrow people and all these frozen bodies, we see the lungs were covered with soot from burning of fuels inside the any type of sod house. That's changed, but there are some very, very serious things going on with houses being overheated, with humidity too low or high, with because we're rebreathing the same air in these homes. With the working in these closed places. And I wish more was done. And I think together, if we make it an issue, hopefully we'll be able to do something. But the reality is that everyone reacts after someone dies or after someone comes down with cancer and it's too late. And there isn't, I feel that the people coming, working in villages and working in the north, there hasn't been much responsibility. And the other thing is, I feel, is that, well, the joke in the north was, what's the typical Eskimo family? How many people? And they say, well, there are five people. There's a mother, a father, two children, and a researcher. And there are people coming up doing all kinds of research on our people, and a lot of it's useless. And I think that Native people and people from Barrow and from communities and village have to say, no, these are our priorities. We need to find out what's happening to all these things, these cooking oils and these things we're working with. We don't want research on, the mating habit of the Inuit are. We don't need to know that. We already know it. We want to know what are these things killing us, our kids. And I think that is the point, is that we have to stand up and take a stand and accept responsibility for telling people these are our needs instead of just accepting everything.
Yes, my analysis in their technology is they got different types of different ways of cleaning this natural gas to a more pure form of source of energy. And in view of Barrow using natural gas as a major source of heat and cooking, mm-hmm. I felt very strongly of, I don't know the technology they use in the cleaning process of the natural gas up there, and I was wondering if you'd, put that into your study. And I felt very strongly to bring that out, and I know that glycol is a carcinogen, and in putting it to the source of heat, like for instance in Barrow, it's a way of inducement of cancer into a whole community. And thank you very much to hear me out.
Thank you.
Dr. Bella, I just have one last thing. The village populations have been growing for quite a few years. You said that ANCSA and the establishment of Native corporations has brought a shift in ideas of life goals the idea that the most respected person in the village was a skilled hunter or fisherman has given way to a certain extent to the idea that someone who is skilled in business, and you put it rather more crassly, someone who has money or can make money, and that this change in goals is one you've observed and is pronounced. Since the economic opportunities in these villages are limited, and that is true throughout the Arctic and subarctic, Greenland, Canada, and Alaska, where is all that likely to lead? That is, the opportunities for people to make money in the villages are really and truly limited. Have you reflected on the outcome of this change?
What concerns me, Commissioner, more even than the ability to make money, is that with the modernization of life as it is, with telephones, with snow machines, with motorized vehicles, with these snow goes and whatever, three-wheelers, we have created a lot of leisure time to go out and haul ice. Might used to take maybe an hour or two or longer, and to go out and to hunt and so on. All those things took a lot of time. Now it's relatively simple, especially with utility doors being built and so on, and water and electricity coming right into our homes. I think one of the things that we have to face is we have been so busy creating so much new leisure time for people. I think that has to be looked at. For me, I think that with too much leisure time and not a solid sense of purpose, then people will tend to turn to recreation in one form or another, boredom or whatever, and that could be in the form of watching a lot of television for countless hours. It could be alcohol, it could be drugs, it could be any of the easy escape type of mechanisms. I think the major problem is going to be a sense of purposeness coming back. In terms of money, you know, that's a hard question. I don't know. I'm not an economist, and I wish I had an answer to pull out of the hat, but I don't. I can just tell you what I see, and then I can tell you that with so much leisure time and people not feeling real good about themselves, that I'm seeing a lot of underlying symptoms come to the surface. I'm seeing depression. I'm seeing a sense of helplessness, a sense of no control of their own destiny, which manifests itself in this giving in. Now, it's not to paint a black picture, because there are a lot of positive things going on. And I remember even in the summer when there was a Job Corps around, and kids in the village were paid to go and haul wood and help clean houses of older people and so on, and how the village kind of bustled with activity, and how when they didn't get paid, then, you know, that activity died down, and
it became a voluntary thing.
Yes, yeah. And I'm saying that traditional spirit of sharing, of cooperating, of working together, of sense of responsibility to the community. I think there's a lot of things to do, and I think there's a lot of work, but it has to be, I think some values have to shift back to traditional values and get away from this monetary sense, the Western sense of, well, if I don't get anything out of it, if you don't pay me, I'm not going to do it. And until we shift back to that, I don't see a big change coming in terms of mental health and depression and these other things that are showing up, things that we've never seen, cancer. And there are other things that are going on too, as well as there is intermarriage, a lot of intermarriage going on. There always has been since the time of the traders. As I said, my father was Eskimo, my mother's Russian. A lot of intermarriage, there's a conflict also in that does the non-native person want to go back to a village and live there? I see even with our own students coming to school, certain amounts of stress sometimes going out with, and this is the age of dating and so on, especially in college, going out with non-native people. They don't understand. They're not sensitive to all the needs I have. They don't want to go back to the village. Native people, you know, might eat different food or whatever. Cultures are different. So I think that there are a lot of new things with the world getting smaller and people becoming more accessible, a lot of new questions coming up that have never been asked. But I don't think it's a sense of hopelessness. But I think that we have to shift away from this measure of Western society and measuring everything in terms of dollars and get back to what it's all about, and this sense of sharing and things that have held our cultures together for centuries. All of a sudden, the extended family and everything else starts to fall apart. And I think a lot of it's due to accepting a number of the bad things from Western society instead of just being selective and taking the best from both worlds.
Yeah. Would you mind leaving me copies of those articles? Is that possible?
Sure. Sure, be happy to. They're marked up, but...
Oh, that's all right.
If that's all right.
Yeah, go ahead. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
But I was wondering, and I want to give a little history and about glycol, and I know this because I was living in Point Hope, and in the boiler systems in Point Hope, they used that glycol to, it went around the pipes in those homes, and it was in Wainwright and Atkusuk and some of the other, in the new houses in Barrow, and I know because that dirty old junk spilled out of my boiler twice, and I was the one who had to mop it up. And so I know, and you're not in a position to say this, and probably a lot of people who work for the government or work for agencies and have positions are not able to say this, but I know that these things are practices, and these poisons and carcinogens are put there with the hope to kill us, as the diseases that were imported and passed around through the mail carriers and through other organizations. Okay, knowing this, and I'd like to know if you could use your position as an Inupiaq to try to get money for preventative measures rather than, you know, the SWAT team, it's not going to work. I want our people to live.
I agree.
But I have another thing, too.
Okay, what is
And I have
name
a promise
too?
is that we'll probably be just like cockroaches, okay?
Yeah.
Cockroaches have been hit by all different kinds of poisons, right? And now they become so immune to it that they can't kill them off, right? And that's how I feel. I have a feeling that that's true with Native Alaska indigenous people.
You're from Point Hope. Could you give me your name, please?
I'm from Glen Allen, but I was living in Point Hope. My name is Evelyn Hash Pete.
Oh, good, good. I just want to start looking into things and want to eventually get back to you.
Okay.
And I really want to bring your concerns to the forefront.
I know you guys are overworked at ANS, but
well, the problem is there's just one person to. We need more help. That's it. Essentially, and I'm not talking about people, just concerned people. And because unfortunately, there's only one of me, and sometimes I find that I'm really stretched. But it doesn't mean I don't care.
Yeah.
I'm really concerned about termination and genocide very, very much. And I didn't mention that, and I'm sorry I didn't. I see a move on the part of the federal government to terminate Alaska Natives and American Indians from federal services. I feel that the federal government has an obligation, a treaty obligation, to Native Americans to provide certain services, and I see a move by this government and by past governments to turn over all the services to us. And the fact has been, I think, especially with Indian Health, they're saying, here, take over your hospitals, take over your everything, Native corporations, take over everything. We'd love to give you all these buildings and just take it and goodbye. But it costs more than $100 million to run medical services in Alaska. And I think that one of the things we have to do is hold the government accountable to Native people for different services, especially medical services. And so I think there's an inherent responsibility of the government to look into these kinds of things. The only time that I have heard in my years of practicing and working in health and social problems the term genocide for Alaska Natives, the killing of Alaska Natives or American Indians, was when an American Indian physician by the name of Dr. Connie, and I can't think of her last name, said that there was something going on in Indian Health by Indian Health Service doing abortions on Indian people and trying to get rid of Native people because the Indian Health Service was doing so many abortions that they were trying to kill us off. That's the only charge I've ever heard. I don't know if the Indian Health Service is still doing abortions. I don't think they are. But at the time they were. And as far as I haven't seen anything to substantiate that, by the way, Commissioner, that I've never, in working Indian Health, never seen anyone back that up. But this is the first time I've heard of people feeling that there was something being done, such as the placement of glycol, to harm other people. I think that even if it's true or not true, the fact that people in a village are concerned is enough justification to look at it.
Yeah, it's such a subtle genocide. I mean, it's so horrible and deplorable and inhumane and everything that it has to be brought out into the open, and I'm glad it came across my lips. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I think I want to thank you, Dr. Mala, for covering as much ground as you have and linking it, as you did, to ANCSA, not all these problems, but some of the implications. And I think we'll just take a five-minute break, and then we'll see if there are others who want to speak tonight.
Good. Thank
Thanks.
You.
Well, nice to see you.
supper hour or the supper time.